Welcome to Life Quest Liberty, live in-depth conversations with today's top writers, editors, and spiritual leaders concerning religious freedom around the world. On today's broadcast, we'll examine local and international factors that may be impacting your right to worship and obey God as your conscience dictates. I'm your Life Quest Liberty host, Charles Mills. Today we spend some time far from our shores to examine some good news, bad news concerning religious freedom. Yes, there is some good news out there. Our guide is Todd McFarlane, Associate General Counsel of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Todd, what's happening out there that we need to know about?
Well, Charles, I think one of the cases we're going to talk about today is a situation we have going in Togo. Mm-hmm. Extra credit to all our listeners that can appropriately place Lomé, Togo on the map. I'll just let you know, when I was booking my ticket for this, I had to call Delta Airlines a couple times. I think I had to talk to them about four times total. And not a single agent on the phone could place it correctly. So the answer to where Togo is West Africa.
West Africa.
It is right between Ghana and Benin. And right there close to Nigeria.
Okay.
So in Lomé is its capital. It's a very small country, former French colony, and it was carved off from Ghana back in the days of colonialism. The people in Togo are sort of relatives and same tribe and so forth as the people there in Ghana.
And I'm assuming that the pilot figured out where it was before you got there, right?
The pilot did find it there. We made it down to Lomé from Paris with no problems.
Good. All right. What was calling you to Togo? I mean, it's not really a vacation land, is it?
It is not a vacation land. The Lomé is on the coast, and they actually have a very nice beach. Well, a nice beach in the sense that it's sandy. It's actually one of the more dangerous parts of Lomé to go to, and never actually got on. I just saw it.
No.
What happened was, we have a pastor that's been in jail down there since March of 2012, and to this day continues to be in prison. And how he got there, and the government of Togo's refusal to let him go raises some serious religious liberty questions, both for him personally and for the church generally.
So what was his heinous crime? What did this man do that required the government to toss him in the clinker?
Well, he didn't do anything. What he's accused of actually is fairly heinous.
Mm.
And what happened was, in the fall of 2011, the best we can tell, there were a series of murders of women who were found in the in fields and so forth, and out in the bush there in the outskirts of Togo. And there was a lot of pressure to arrest someone and find the people who did this, especially from some of the women's rights movements there in Lomé. The government made an initial arrest, but then it turned out, when the killings continued, that person, of course, didn't do it, and they had to let them go. The pressure was then building on them quite a bit. So the approach they took with this was, they had a special sort of, gendarme or particular part of the army who was focusing on this, and they found a gentleman who was walking with a girl, and she was a girl, who sells stuff on the streets, which is a common thing there in Lomé.
Mm-hmm.
And they stopped him and questioned him and questioned her, and took him to the police station, and ended up extracting a confession from him that he was going to take her into the woods for the purpose of murdering her and then draining her blood, which he would then sell to various individuals.
Oh, for heaven's sakes.
And they then ask him, who was your compatriots? Who was the hired you? Who took the blood from you and so forth, and, this blood traffic? And he gave the names of, I think, up to eight individuals, one of which was an Adventist pastor that was in jail and then an Adventist church member. The names of the individuals he gave, the only connection that they really had to him was, there were people who had helped him. He had stopped by the union office there in Lomé, asked to speak with a pastor, and had some connection with the church, and Pastor Montero, who was the one who's in jail, he happened to be available that day. And, he had then followed up with that and taken this gentleman to church a couple of times and helped him out in various ways. And, when they were attempting to extract a confession with him, and the gentleman who is now says that he was tortured during that, mm-hmm. says he just simply was thinking of names he could come up with.
Mm-hmm.
And, the people who had helped him were the ones he was able to come up with. When the police then followed up on that, they went to the office, they arrested Pastor Montero, They then searched the union office, our conference office there, you know, the ministry of office where he worked for blood. They also went to his church, searched that for blood, you know, around the podium and the baptismal tank that was below the podium there, found a jar of honey. It was the only thing they found. But they still threw him in jail and have maintained and kept him there now 7-8 months later. You know, the disturbing part of this is that, I mean, the idea, first of all, it's fanciful and unbelievable. Mm-hmm. The idea that this gentleman would take someone in the woods, kill them, and then drain their blood, and then be able to sell that. I mean, this idea that people, I mean, who is it that needs these, you know, needs human blood for rituals and so forth? The other thing, and again, this is why this is just complete fantasy, you know, we've talked to physicians and so forth. It turns out that after killing a person, draining their blood, takes a lot of work and skill. You would really have to know what you're doing.
Yes.
You know, and the idea that some untrained, unskilled gentleman can do that, you know, basically out in the woods in Lomé, Togo, Africa, is just unbelievable. The other thing is, the women who were killed before, there was no forensics done. There was no autopsy. There was no evidence that the blood was drained. The best there was some pictures, which I had the unfortunate occasion to see, you know, that showed that, you know, in some instances it looks like they were probably sexually assaulted. But there's no forensic evidence to say that anyone had their blood drained. And again, and then the idea that an Adventist pastor would do this and the Adventist church would use human blood in its rituals and need that and to search a church for that, I mean, what it does is it meets literally the definition of a blood libel, which we thought, you know, was something that was beyond us, you know, as a society. You know, at this stage, the government of Togo, the best we can tell, talking to people, you know, sort of off the record and, you know, what we're told by our lawyers there and everything is that they understand now that he probably or is innocent, that he didn't do it. I mean, there was a, for instance, you know, the gentleman who was accused of doing this, they had two physicians interview him and write reports. Mm-hmm. And both those physician reports, and we met with one of the physicians, said, no, this guy made this up. He's not telling the truth. You know, his story's not credible. And of course, now he's denying it. He's the gentleman is saying that, you know, is saying that that isn't true, but they're still holding him in jail. And we think the motivation there is that if they release these people from jail, and keep in mind, this made a lot of news. I mean, you know, we have back in March and April, you know, it was on the front page of the local papers, and, you know, they caught these, and the government was very happy to report that. But now, if they release them, if they release our pastor, they have to release the rest of the people, and then they have to admit that they have no one who'd committed these crimes. And, of course, the reality is they don't know who committed the crimes, and at this stage, the odds of finding out who did that are next to zero. And that's not something that the Togo government is, you know, is happy to do. And in that respect, they're not that much different than most people in governments throughout the world that don't like to admit mistakes.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious to know, have the crimes continued after these guys were tossed in jail?
It's difficult to answer that question. That is one of the arguments that the government had made initially was it seems like that these crimes haven't continued. Of course, there's a lot of reasons why that may have happened, and that doesn't necessarily mean that they have the right people in jail. I mean, if this truly is a serial killer, serial killers, you know, stop and start, we know from, you know, evidence here in the States for a number of reasons.
Well, this is stomach turning here, I have to say. And like you say, the fact that there is a blood traffic, a traffic in human blood, is just beyond comprehension. When you went to Togo, what's that like? You are called to go to different places of the world. Give us a little experience with you here. Share with what it was like and what the people were like and what you saw and what you heard.
Yeah, well, it takes a while to get there. It takes about a day to get there. You have to fly from D.C. to Paris and then Paris down to Togo. We were there during a nice time of year. The weather was actually great. It wasn't, you know, the temperature was in the high 70s, low 80s.
Wow.
The people of Togo, it's a fairly safe country. We went around with our hosts there and even walked around the compound where, you know, our was during the day, and it was fine. We met with several government officials and so forth and other individuals, and everyone was friendly. So it's a it's a developing country, certainly to say the least. Yeah. There's a fair amount of poverty throughout Togo, you know, and issues need addressed. We did have the opportunity to visit our Pastor Montero in prison a couple of times. Yeah. I highly recommend that you do everything you can to avoid being in a Togo prison. It is overcrowded. I mean, I think it was built originally for a couple hundred people at most, I think like 180. It has well over 600 in it now. When Pastor Montero was first put in there, he was put in a cell that had, I think, around 80 people in it, way overcrowded. You can't really, I mean, they do feed supposedly one time a day, but it's beyond just bad food. It's just not, you know, I mean, it's you really could not stay alive there for any length of time unless you have support on the outside. And so the two Adventists are in there, Pastor Montero and the church member. Their spouses alternate coming in, one in the morning, one in the afternoon, and then they bring food. You know, of course, they visit with their husbands.
Yeah.
And then they bring food and supplies and so forth into the prison for them. And that's, you know, it's. I've been in a fair amount of prisons here in the United States, always professionally, by the way, never as a never as a an inmate. And they tend to be, you know, fairly controlled environments. The Togo prison is really not that. I mean, I joked you could sneak anything short of a tank into there if you wanted. But, you know, it's quite frankly, the prison is not, I mean, it's not a good place to be in a long term. It's a very dangerous place to be. But it is, compared to, you know, especially even some U.S. prisons, it is not that violent of a place, comparatively speaking. But it is so overcrowded, you know, and if you get sick there, I mean, you're just up a creek. Though I will say, ironically, within the prison itself, it is mostly run by the prisoners. Indications are that maybe up to half the people in there are completely innocent of any crime. So that actually helps. One of the problems with having a prison is that it's filled with criminals. Well, when you have a prison that's not filled with criminals, then that tends to make it, to some extent, a safer place. But I still don't want to say it's still a very bad place to be, very dangerous place to be. In fact, when we were there during the first visit, we were sort of one of the visiting areas, and there was a gentleman there, one of the inmates, who started to get into a tussle or a fight with, it wasn't clear who it was with or what it was about, but, you know, when you start to have sort of people wrestling and so on, then he attempted to actually sort of leave one of the gates, and the other prisoners were holding him back and so forth, and so, you know, we felt the need to sort of get away from that pretty quickly. But it can be, like I said, it's a place that you can turn very dangerous very quickly. I should also say, you know, I was there with Pastor John Graz, and, you know, he had the opportunity on Sabbath to preach in the prison to the prisoners there and so forth. And that was quite an experience, being able to talk to a group of prisoners there in Togo.
Well, when I hear stories like this, I'm always trying to figure out why things happen. It almost sounds like the reason for this happening has nothing to do with the crime. It has nothing to do with the people involved. It simply has to do with saving face by the powers that be that want to make sure that something is done about this crime, no matter if it's right or wrong.
There's a certain amount of that. I mean, there is the, you know, there's the blood libel that was made against, you know, Pastor Montero and the church, and an unwillingness to back off on that when the evidence points contrary. Yeah. The more I was there and the more I talked to the people in Togo and the more I talked to the officials and to our lawyers and so forth, I was struck by how this wouldn't directly happen in the United States just because of the process we have in place, but the same principle, the same idea that governments unwilling and police agencies unwilling to back off when they know that, you know, something, you know, have evidence to the contrary. I mean, we know that's happened dozens of times.
Yes.
I think, you know, the Innocence Project has shown in the United States, I think, I forget how many it was recently, I think may have hit their 1,000th person who was released on DNA evidence.
Yeah.
And in all those cases, there was contrary evidence. There was questions about it. There was witnesses who were sketchy, who gave conflicting evidence and so forth. But, you know, once they made an arrest, once they were committed to it, they were unwilling to sort of admit that they made a mistake. Now, what happened was, you know, because of scientific advancements in that case, we then had definitive evidence that they were actually innocent. That's sort of a unique place in history. We've really never had that happen before. But it shows what happens when law enforcement and prosecutors, you know, have this bias. You know, and the other thing, now this isn't the case in Pastor Montero's case, but, you know, a lot of the people in the United States who were charged with these crimes, I mean, these were not good people necessarily.
Yeah.
I mean, these were people with criminal backgrounds. These people were on the margins of society. You know, it's easy for a prosecutor to say, well, of course he committed this crime. He has this rap sheet that's as long as my arm. Not a big stretch to think he committed this murder. Of course, later scientific evidence was able to show that In fact, that didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And so this sort of approach is universal, unfortunately. And in Togo, it's just a little bit more sort of extreme in the sense that the human rights reports and so forth demonstrate this. I mean, they don't really have an independent judiciary. They also, in the United States, we have something, a right to a speedy trial. Mm-hmm. You get charged with a crime, you have a right to go in front of a jury in a fairly short period of time.
Yeah.
There, people can be in pretrial detention and held before actually tried. 2, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years. And so, unless you have someone on the outside and money for a lawyer and so forth and everything, which Pastor Montero does, just getting your case heard can be next to impossible.
In a recent Liberty Magazine editorial, Lincoln Steed wrote, "A religious community not willing to extend to others the rights they demand for themselves is not at all helpful for religious freedom. We must not confuse faith with wishful thinking. We must hold up the increasingly counterintuitive banner of religious freedom. It can be a revolutionary banner if adopted." For more insights, visit libertymagazine.org. Our guest today is Todd McFarlane, Associate General Counsel of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. We're talking about cases around the world that are of interest to anyone who is concerned about religious freedom, and brings up an idea in my mind, Todd, talking about this case in Togo, that sometimes justice is blind to truth. We like to think that justice is blind and will have to be proven, but there seems to be undercurrent issues that take place in certain people's defenses. The way the cops feel about you, the way the judicial system feels about the way the country, the culture feels about it. How is it possible, or is it possible in this world, and more importantly in this country, to get a fair trial, Todd, when all of these other feeders are gnawing at the truth?
Well, that is a problem. That's an issue. And I just want to be clear, especially in the United States. I mean, there's no question that the vast, vast, vast majority of people in prison are there and guilty of the crimes that they committed and deserve to be there.
Mm-hmm.
But what you have is situations, especially in high-profile cases such as murders and rapes and, putting those two together, in other situations where there's a lot of pressure to come up with a guilt, get this person off the street and solve the crime. What you happen is a lot of biases sort of feed into that, and those biases take another forms. First of all, if we can start sort of at the end of the process, there is a legal presumption, and everyone's heard of it, that a person accused of a crime is innocent. In other words, you're innocent until proven guilty.
Yeah.
And that is, in the United States and most Western countries, that is a presumption. And juries are instructed and so forth, but that is not how most people walking in view it. In other words, most criminal defense lawyers will say, you put a jury impaneled, there is a view amongst most juries that if the person's sitting there, if the cops arrested him, if it got to that stage, they have to be guilty. Now, that doesn't mean that the jury can't be convinced otherwise, but when a jury looks across that box at the defendant's table and the person's sitting there, there is definitely a sort of bias that person has to be guilty. The other problem that happens, too, is, especially with the more heinous crimes, there is a view that somebody has to be held responsible for that. In other words, a little girl is raped and killed. That's a horrible thing. It's turns your stomach. Mm-hmm. And of course, prosecutors are good about putting the evidence on and putting the graphic pictures up and showing to the jury. And a jury, there's a feeling like, well, someone has to be held responsible for this. And who's the only person that can be held responsible for? It's the person that's sitting across from them. And for many jurors, the idea that someone is going to, quote, get away with this is just something that's unpalatable. And we know that juries have messed this up beyond belief. The other sort of biases that come in on this is witness testimony. There's this view that is starting to change with some scientific evidence that we've come up with and how DNA has proven it. You know, a person will say, you know, yes, I think that XYZ person sitting there at the table, you committed the crime. You know, and the juries, and these are not witnesses that have a bias necessarily, but it turns out there have been, you know, not to put this in too graphic terms, there have been women who have been raped, who have testified that the person, you know, obviously they had to get pretty close, that the person who raped them, not necessarily wearing a disguise or a mask or anything, that that was the defendant. Mm-hmm. And then with scientific, you know, with DNA evidence, it turns out that woman was just wrong. Oh, they testified and sent this person to jail for years, decades, saying that they're the one that committed the crime when they didn't. And what we know is that people's ability to identify and recall information like that isn't nearly as perfect as we thought it would be. And so, you know, the other area that we have learned on as far as information bias comes in is false confession. Again, DNA evidence has shown this. I mean, Charles, you know, if you were accused of a crime, you know, most people like to think that, you know, they would never confess to a crime they didn't commit. Why would you ever say you raped someone or you murdered someone when you didn't do that? And I got to say, I mean, that would be my view as well. But when you put a combination of a lot of these people will be put a lot of pressure on them, hours and hours and hours, the pride to sleep, they'll be lied to. And then the other thing is a lot of these individuals, you know, these are not Harvard graduates for the most part. And, you know, it turns out that you can get false confessions from people, and it happens on a routine basis. Now, it doesn't mean that every confession is false, and it doesn't mean that, you know, that this happens for the majority of cases, but it turns out that, you know, police can and do extract, you know, using certain techniques and so forth, including violence at times, false confessions from people. So you put that all together. The other aspect on this that is a contributor to is there's a lot of good lawyers out there. There's a lot of good criminal defense lawyers, but a lot of times these people didn't get the best defense that they should have. That these were lawyers, you know, who didn't do the investigation they were supposed to, may have not had all the resources they needed, may not have been just the best lawyers. I mean, the reality is, when people go to law school, I think it's only about 2% of lawyers end up going into criminal work at all, either prosecution or defense. And there are a lot of good criminal defense lawyers out there, but they cost money. And, you know, a lot of times these are people, you know, while a person's entitled to a lawyer under, you know, the Supreme Court said, Supreme Court's made it very clear, they're not entitled to the best defense, they're just entitled to an adequate defense. And that defense, by the way, you know, this has been overturned, but at one point down in Texas, a court had found a lawyer who fell asleep during the trial gave an adequate defense. Now, like I said, on appeal, that ended up getting eventually, I think the Supreme Court ended up backing off on that. But that's the level of hostility that criminal defendants sort of face, especially on appeal and within the criminal justice system.
Now, the reason I'm asking and the reason I'm listening so closely to what you're saying is here, I am on call presently for jury duty in my county. I have to make those weekly calls to find out if I'm supposed to go in and be a jury. And I've often wondered how I would handle that because I want to make sure that justice is served. I want to make sure that when I'm sitting in the jury box looking over at that poor individual, that man or woman or young person who's sitting over there, I want to make sure that what I decide on this case is truth. Is it possible? I mean, do all juries go home at the end of the trial with that reasonable doubt that we're not supposed to have when we convict someone?
No, I think most juries and most people who are on juries, especially when they get done, there's some exception to this, but many of them are absolutely convinced they did the right thing. There's no question or doubt in their mind. I mean, you know, you look at the 1,000-plus cases and people that were found actually innocent, you know, because of DNA evidence, an innocence project. I guarantee you the vast majority of the jurors, everybody on there thought they'd done the right thing. They felt good. Yes, we sent the person away. But, you know, we've learned, you know, with group dynamics and so forth, first of all, there's the issues I was talking about before about the jury getting the evidence. The other thing is, people tend to selectively look at evidence in a way that confirms the way they want to go. So in other words, if they're going to convict a person, they're going to dismiss the evidence that may go the other way. None of those juries wanted to convict an innocent person. I mean, that I'm convinced of. They all wanted to do the right thing. But we have to know and understand our own biases in such a way that, you know, when you have the person there in front of you who's accused of murdering and killing, you know, the 15-year-old girl, mm-hmm. you know, and raping her, you know, you got to ask yourself, if there's evidence that points towards innocence or points away from guilt, are you just dismissing that and minimizing it to confirm, you know, the outcome that you think is the right one? So in other words, you know, here's the other problem is courts won't do this, and they're very hesitant to do this. I mean, reasonable doubt is not quantifiable. Mm-hmm. You can't say, you know, it's 90%, 98%, you know, whatever. I mean, that's not the way the courts talk. Think of it this way. If you're a juror and you've got a person sitting in front of you and you're almost positive, you are pretty certain that the person committed this, you don't really have much doubt, but there's a couple of things in the back of your mind. You're like, well, you know, if it goes this way, maybe, you know, maybe the person is that. People are unwilling to acquit a person that they're pretty certain committed it, but maybe not 100%. So what they do is, rather than kicking them loose, they minimize that evidence. The evidence that would point the other way, they just say, oh, no, that's not relevant, you know, for whatever reason, and just dismiss it. So when they come to a conclusion, they're absolutely 100% convinced that they're right, even though there's evidence that would point towards an acquittal.
Now, fold this over into our relationship with God and our relationship with other people and the whole concept of religious freedom. We just have a minute and a half left here. What should be our attitude as we look at the evidence of God and the evidence that other religions are throwing at us about God?
Well, I think, you know, from our perspective, you know, as Christians and as individuals committed to religious liberty, you know, we have to look at this and saying, why do you believe what you do and are you certain about it? In other words, you know, looking at the evidence, explaining it, coming to a conclusion in your own mind. And the reason I think that is important is because over time and over decades, you know, people may have unanswered questions, and there may be something that clicks, you know, 10, 15, 20 years down the road, 30 years down the road, that you know, may make a person question God. And there are questions out there. There's no issue about that. I mean, the question of theodicy, why a loving God lets bad things happen, is a tough one. Mm-hmm. And we shouldn't shy away from the tough questions, but rather seek to address them head on.
God asks us to come and reason with him. And so you're saying, I hear you saying, that it really is that personal sitting down with God in prayer or with his word or listening to his still small voice and letting him reason with us to make sure that we are convicted in our own heart that what he is saying to us is true. Am I right?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely.
All right. Very good. Well, Todd, this has been an interesting discussion, and I'm very interested in this because I am on call for jury duty, and I've always wondered what I am going to do, how am I going to think, and you've given me some wonderful things to think about, and I appreciate that. Also, listener, I want to invite you to come and reason with Liberty Magazine at their website, libertymagazine.org. You need to educate yourself. We all do need to educate ourselves on these issues so that when we look across the table at someone who is accused or someone looks across at us and is accusing us, we know where we stand and we know how to be the judge and the jury that we need to be when we deal with religious liberty issues. And I appreciate, Todd, that you have given us these insights. Todd McFarland is Associate General Counsel of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Todd, thank you so much for being with us today.
Charles, it's great to be with you.
And until next time, ladies and gentlemen, may you rest in the freedom of God's love. Goodbye, everyone. You've been listening to Life Quest Liberty. To further explore the issues discussed on today's program, visit www.libertymagazine.org. Join us again next week at this same time as we examine more of the threats and challenges facing your religious freedom. May God keep the flames of religious freedom burning in your heart today.